From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, a Madison doctor tries to eliminate a key barrier to affordable care, insurance.
I sort of remove that as the means for health care, and instead people pay a subscription fee directly to me, and I can keep it very low by not billing insurance.
Later, a new multi-platform news network debuts in Milwaukee and tries to change how news stories are told. A Milwaukee man's new memoir gives us a unique view of growing up in 60s and 70s New York, and the place of digital billboards in the sky and in the art world.
There are more and more environmental issues about what is going on above our heads. And one example is that city lights limit the stars we can see. Digital billboards are becoming more and more prominent as part of the sky environment.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Americans today begin selecting health exchanges as key parts of the health care reform legislation go into effect. Although even the Affordable Care Act's staunchest supporters say there will be glitches in the system, it's designed to connect millions of uninsured or underinsured Americans with access to medical care. Meanwhile, a Madison doctor is trying to pioneer a system that aims to fill in some gaps. Dr. Will Shupp opened a clinic around 6 weeks ago that employs direct primary care. Shupp joins us on the line now from Madison to explain how it works. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Walk me through how your clinic operates. What are you doing that is different than what we're used to in medicine?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's actually very different. The whole basis of the practice is sort of structured differently based on the way that I get paid, essentially. In a typical practice, everything is done on a fee-for-service basis where people come in for an office visit, usually about 15 minutes, and that office visit is billed, and that's sort of the whole encounter. In my case, I sort of remove that as the means for healthcare, and instead people pay a subscription fee directly to me, and I can keep it very low by not billing insurance, and then I can take care of them all the time if things happen to come up, or if we need to take care of their health maintenance or things like that. We can do it without forcing them to come into the clinic, but also by making it available that they can come in anytime for free.
Well, and it's interesting because you don't bill insurance, but in a way, what people are kind of getting when they're subscribing, if you will, is a kind of insurance, right?
That's right. It's similar. It's sort of like a co-op with your doctor where, everyone sort of buys a share of me in a sense, and then I'm available to all of them.
How do the services you offer and then the cost to the patients differ from what many of us are probably used to then?
Well, a typical office visit usually costs between $150 and about $250 just for the doctor's time. And in my case, all office visits are completely free after you pay the subscription fee, which is between $30 and $50 a month. And then things like procedures that usually cost, for example, for a joint injection, that's usually about $200. I do that completely for free. Like I say, people sort of buy me with the subscription fee, and then I'm available to do whatever they need from a medical standpoint.
How are you able to cover the costs of the supplies, if you will, the things that you are injecting people with or the lab work that's being done?
Yeah, that's another big thing is that usually those things get marked up quite a bit from the cost. The difference between the cost of something and the insurance price is usually about 10 times more at the insurance price. So for example, a steroid that gets injected into the knee, it usually costs about $8. So that's usually what I charge them. Well, I have them just pick it up from the pharmacy and bring it in, and then I inject it. In the case of labs, the labs usually cost about $6 to $14 at cost, but they're usually billed out between $80 and up to $250. So I just have them pay the actual cost of the lab instead of the insurance price, and it makes it affordable for them to actually get the monitoring that they need.
This is essentially unique in Wisconsin. There are some other clinics that adopt elements of what you're doing, but if I understand correctly, your clinic is the only, for lack of a better term, you know, grassroots direct primary care clinic operating in the state, as it does. So what was the need you saw that you're trying to fill? Who is this best suited to serve?
You know, I was finding that a lot of my patients that either had no insurance or high deductible insurance, where they essentially people that have to pay the full price for their medical care, usually avoid getting it, or they get some and then don't come back for the follow-up because it's so expensive. And that was really a problem, in my opinion. About 30,000 people in Madison alone have no insurance. So that's a pretty big chunk of the population who gets a different level of health care just because of the coverage that they have.
Well, and as you say, that there is a sizable chunk of people out there without health insurance. That is due to change. So how do you see what you're doing as fitting in with the Affordable Care Act as it's set to be enacted?
That's a great question. You know, I think time will certainly tell, but I think that what people are going to find is that when they go onto the exchange and look for plans that they can afford, most people will have to go for the bronze tier or the silver tier, which is still with a pretty high deductible, about, you know, $5,000 or $2,000, which still puts those people in the category of, you know, high deductible insurance and makes it hard for them to get the health care that they need. I think having health insurance for everyone is great, but we still need to solve the problem of providing affordable health care to people so they can get the things that they need.
Why do you think your model has not been adopted more frequently? Is the system set up such that it's difficult for a physician to decide to do this?
Well, there are about 450 of these across the country. Most of them are on the East Coast and the West Coast. But I think, and this has been going on for about 10 years now, and it's growing, but it hasn't really picked up in the Wisconsin area. And there's a couple reasons for that. One, the big reason is that all of the doctors, at least in Madison, are on a non-compete agreement. So they wouldn't be able to start one of these practices even if they wanted to. They would have to, you know, pick up their house and their kids and move somewhere else if they wanted to do this. So that's a big barrier to entry. And the other thing, too, is that it's a risk, you know, to start a practice that's totally novel and different. And put yourself out there like that. So that's not something that doctors typically do.
Well, and what are the advantages? I mean, you've kind of gone over what the advantages to the patients would be. What are the advantages you see to yourself as a practicing physician?
Well, for one thing, you know, I can have a patient panel that's much smaller, and actually that's one of the aspects of my practice is that my cap will be 500 patients as opposed to a typical practice that has about 2,000 patients. And that way I can really focus on them and make sure that I'm doing a good job of taking care of them, which actually makes a big difference for my job satisfaction for one thing. But it also makes my day much less hectic, much less rushed at all times, and makes it a much more rewarding career, in my opinion. But yeah, I guess that would be the biggest thing for me.
Yeah, you at the same time though are their physician 24/7. You are always the on call physician. How do you see your ability to not burn out after about 6 months?
That's a good question. You know, I think a big piece of that is that patients don't call you in the middle of the night unless they need to, so there really aren't very many calls, to be honest. There are calls in the evening or in the morning, but I don't really get woken up in the night. So I don't think it really adds a whole lot of stress to what I'm doing to be available. But it also makes it, it's very valuable to the patients to be able to talk to somebody who knows them, when they need it.
I
think it's worth it.
Do you anticipate getting a vacation in there at some point?
Yeah. You know, everybody asks me that, actually. That isn't a big deal. I can certainly, there are plenty of doctors who will cover for me if I leave town, but I can stay available over the phone if people need to call in. That doesn't bother me at all.
I guess doctors have always had solo practices like this in the past.
That's right. Well, actually, my dad and my grandpa did. My dad still does down in Des Moines, Iowa. And so I've seen the way that this operates, my whole life, and it actually works out just fine.
Well, yeah. Let me ask you about that. Given that you've had these generations of doctors ahead of you, how did watching their careers as physicians influence what you wanted to be as a doctor?
I think it definitely informed me on, what I wanted to do in terms of taking care of people. But certainly once I went to medical school and residency and saw the way that medicine is practiced nowadays, which is a little bit different, it really made me think about how I want to practice medicine and, how I want to sort of set up my practice and the way I take care of people. So I think it made a big difference.
Do you think in doing this, it helps that you have not been practicing medicine for decades? I mean, do you think it would have been much harder for you to decide to open a clinic in this model if you had been a doctor already for 20 years?
I think so. It would take a much bigger leap. I would have to, drop everything that I had built up to do it. So I think it would be harder. I do talk to a lot of older doctors who are interested in switching over to this model, but it takes a lot of dedication to do something like that. So I think it would get in the way.
You've been open for about 6 weeks now, is that right?
Yeah, just over 6 weeks, yeah.
What has been the hardest aspect to getting the clinic and the system up and running?
That's a good question. There's a lot of moving pieces to a clinic, and you don't really realize it until you start actually building one. So there were a lot of things to learn kind of at each step of the way. I think, the hardest part is to plug a system like this that I'm building into the kind of overall ecosystem of the Madison Healthcare, mainly because it's a very HMO-driven system here. But I've managed to sort of plug myself in, to each place so that we can, so that I can provide care to patients no matter which, system they work within.
Well, and given that you're not within, the typical HMO system, what is your relationship with specialists whose care your patients might someday need?
Yeah, I can work with any specialist in town, and I'd like to sort of develop a relationship where I can really work closely with certain specialists, but I can be flexible based on what my patients need. Another big thing that I'm working on with a couple of specialists in town here who actually do some work in Milwaukee as well is to set up a telemedicine system where I can bring a specialist into the room in my clinic and have them help to solve a diagnostic conundrum or answer a very specialized question so that they don't have to see a specialist for it. They don't have to go to the specialist. And I can ask questions as well, and we can really close the loop and move forward with that patient's care without delay. And I think that has a lot of potential, and that's the main goal that I'm working on with specialist care. But for now, I can certainly interface with any system.
And presumably, some of this is where the health exchanges might come in as well.
That's right. Yeah, and in fact, in the future, direct primary care practices will be able to compete on the exchange.
But that is not yet the case in Wisconsin, correct?
That's right. It'll be sometime in 2014. To compete on the exchange, you have to combine with a high deductible plan. So it's a combination of insurance and direct primary care. And in fact, in Seattle, the very first example of that was just released yesterday. So there's a lot of progress being made there.
Well, it's really interesting and thought-provoking stuff. Will Shupp, thank you so much, and hope we can talk again down the road. Best of luck to you.
Yeah, very good. Thank you very much.
Dr. Will Shupp is a primary care physician in Madison. His clinic is believed to be the first in the state to offer a direct primary care model, one he hopes to someday offer through the health exchanges that are going into effect today as part of the Affordable Care Act. The founders of a new television network hope to do to news what Will Shupp is hoping to do to primary care. We'll talk with the founders of the fledgling network when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. When CNN first went on the air in 1980, it marked the launch of the first 24/7 television network devoted solely to news. A lot has happened in the 33 years since, and the television news landscape is now filled with all news and analysis options. Yet, as the choice has increased, the number of people turning to television for news is decreasing. The founders of a new multi-platform, including television network, believe part of the problem lies in the old-fashioned way in which TV is telling stories. The new network, called TouchVision, promises not news stories, but what it terms news movies. It went on the air and online in recent weeks. It's headquartered in Chicago, but its first broadcast outlet is on channel 58.4 in Milwaukee. We reached two of the founders of the network separately by Skype. First, we're joined by Chief Content Officer Lee Abrams. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Can you explain the concept of a news movie to me?
Traditionally, television news are newscasts, where there's anchors behind a desk and clips of news that are usually supplemented with a reporter and a mic and all that. This is more of a pure cinematic approach to storytelling. One way of looking at it is we don't report, we transport, meaning we like to transport people not to a newsroom when they watch, but to the actual point of where the story is. We joke that if we were doing a story on Cairo, you could almost smell the food stalls, you know, of that city, because it takes you there rather than to a studio. Another way of looking at it is just one of our internal slogans or checklists we have for all of our people producing is eye, ear, brain. That's where we want every piece to be visually stunning, using every imaginable piece of video we can find, from retro to graphics to animation to just raw footage. So there's a cinematic effect. It's, again, like watching a movie of the news rather than a cast of the news. The other component is ear, where every story has a soundtrack to it. It can, and we're very cautious of it getting a little overblown or even hokey, but by being really cautious about it, we can add a sonic element that really, I think, elevates the whole storytelling process. In other words, if we're doing a story on tornadoes in Texas, we might use a Willie Nelson piece. Or if we were doing a story on war, maybe it's Wagner. So we're using as much sound as possible to tell the story, again, much like a soundtrack in a movie. And the third thing is brain, where we want it to be intelligent, not elite, but not dumb. Want it to have a plot and really tell a story rather than just sort of going through the news and onto the next story, onto the next. And the whole result is something we came up with, which was news movie, because it really is like that, a movie of the world at the moment.
Well, what did you see? Where did news anchors and reporters, to some degree, get in the way for you?
In all due respect, there are traditional newscasts that are very successful, and we all watch them, and that's great. But we just see an opportunity for a new way to deliver news. One way of looking at it is sort of on the far left, you have pop culture news, which is amusing and very, very light. And it's all about the latest from the Paris Hiltons. Then on the right side, you have very traditional news with the anchor people and, you know, the furniture and all that. And we just think there's an opportunity in the middle where it's not light and pop, but it's not traditional. It just might be time for a reinvention of news. And it was sort of what really also helped was traditional news has become material for parody, particularly Onion and even the Jon Stewarts. You know, people are kind of making fun of the traditional news. So rather than making fun of it or whining about it, let's try a whole new different approach, sort of blow up the playbook and see what we can come up with. And I think we came up with something that's going to engage the public, at least our target, which is more 18 to 40 type people.
Do you feel, is there a certain overlap with social media that's happening here? I mean, it seems like the idea of being at least to some degree unfiltered and certainly on the ground where you're coming from takes a cue from the Twitters and the Facebooks of the world.
Yeah, you know, we look at it first and foremost as a reimagination of the television news experience. And if there's no such thing as social media, I still think it would have dramatic impact. We look at social media as just a modern marketing tool. And, you got to have visibility on Facebook and the ability to share stories and interactivity. But it's really modeled after a reimagination of the product itself, because there are a lot of news services out there that are all about sharing and tweeting.
Sure.
And all that stuff. But we're really all about the experience of watching and listening to news in a whole new way. So I look at social media as an important marketing component rather than anything that drives the content.
Well, so in terms of the content generation, where is it coming from? I mean, conventional news outlets are obviously closing down bureaus around the world. So how does a startup hope to get a true worldview? Where are you reaching out to and how are you reaching out?
So we've done licensing deals with most, if not all, of the major sources for raw video. But it's interesting that we try to stretch out beyond just the traditional. And, you know, we did a thing the other day, a thing called Deja News, where we took old newsreels from, you know, 50, 60 years ago and aired them with a little opening about why we're doing it. But we did one on Syria, and I think it was from the 50s, and it was all about the Syrian rebels fighting the government, but it was a newsreel from years ago. And some of that stuff is fascinating, too, just finding new ways of telling today's stories. There's so much archival stuff out there that's just fascinating that rarely sees the light of day, at least on traditional television.
Now, one of the defenses that you probably have heard people offer to the conventional way of doing things with television news is that the thing about visible anchors and reporters and bylines is the sense of accountability they offer. There is something about knowing who your news is coming from. First of all, how do you address that issue? And secondly, who is your news coming from?
The way the process works is, you know, we have editorial meetings in a newsroom and all that, just like any traditional news organization has. And once we determine what stories are for the day, we will comb all of our assets, again, ranging from Reuters to CNN, AP, and beyond, which are certainly credible. And then we do what's called touch visionize it, which is where we add our narration, add additional visual elements, we add our soundtrack, edit it, and then it goes out to the viewer. And our mix of people is pretty much an even balance of people professionally trained in journalism. Our executive producer comes from WPIX, one of the bigger stations in New York. He was news director. Our managing editor comes from NBC here in Chicago. And then we have a lot of people who, particularly on the creative side, who don't have news experience, and we hired them for their sort of new take on things. And in fact, they don't have any baggage as far as what it has to look like or is supposed to look like based on tradition. These people come from every place, from ad agencies to independent filmmakers. But as far as the credibility question, that's probably the most important thing, because one problem with social media is you don't know who to believe. So it's very important, and we have many filters here that ensure we're telling the truth to the best of our ability. And we also are very conscious about both sides. And, you know, let people decide. It really is fair and balanced. But, you know, number one point, and I think a differentiator from a lot of the up-and-coming internet-based news sources is, you know, the journalistic integrity is absolutely critical. We have lots of cross-checks to make sure we're telling it like it is.
What's your take on localizing the experience? The television part of it is only one component, but do you envision a day where you're going to be tailoring things specifically towards viewers in a local area versus any other local area?
Well, we do that now. Every local affiliate, like 58 in Milwaukee, has a 3-minute cutaway where, in the TouchVision style, they do 3 minutes of local news. As we grow our TV affiliate base, that's the expectation that everybody will have their 3 minutes to present the local story. The other 57 minutes, you know, we are geared for national and global news. But, you know, local certainly is important, and that's why the affiliates contribute their segments.
This is not a model that exists really anywhere else. Is there a little sense within the newsroom of learning as you go?
Oh, God, yeah. As a matter of fact, since we occupied we called it an oasis rather than a newsroom, but it is a newsroom. We occupied it January 2nd, and literally up through August, we have been rehearsing and holding what we call boot camps, which sounds scary, but they're not. And those are sessions that go several hours where we just interact with each other and talk about how do we pull this off. It's all written, and, you know, we have a playbook. Okay, now we've got to execute it. And so that was just a group learning experience for months. And again, it's similar to what we went through at XM, because we had 2 years while they built the satellites to do the same thing, boot camp, unlearn everything we've learned and relearn it for the new era and for what we are. So, yeah, the learning experience has been remarkable for everybody, including, you know, certainly myself. And but it's been fun. You know, it's how do we become you know, the next major global news source? And you know, there's a lot of unwinding cliches and a lot of just talking amongst ourselves and, you know, rethinking how can we do everything better. And we're still learning, but I think we're at a point now where it's launch worthy. But I think it'll be an ongoing learning experience. The next major learning experience will be, you know, hearing feedback from actual viewers, because they may like some of our features and dislike others. And, you know, certainly in a controlled way, we'll be receiving a lot of input.
Well, it is it's really interesting stuff, and I wish you the best of luck with it. Lee Abrams, thanks so much.
Well, I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Lee Abrams is co-founder and chief content officer for TouchVision, a news network that launched on TV and the internet in recent weeks. We also reached Steve Saslow, another co-founder of TouchVision. He holds the title of CEO of the network and is in charge of just about everything except the news content. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start where this all started for you, with the idea that broadcast news could be re-envisioned. Where was this in your mind before it became a reality?
There's two parts. Number one was a long time ago, Lee and I had worked together. This is the 70s, on our own and eventually at NBC, developing the Source Network. And Lee had put the notion forth at that time of, gee, you know, television news really hasn't reinvented itself in a long time. And we had done that with the Source Network, which was the first network of news and information to work, and I'll use the word collegially, with the rock radio format that Lee had pretty much put together. And as time went on, and we're talking a number of years, Lee is working on developing the concept, the one that you see that's up in Milwaukee. And I'm running around with agencies and watching technology, because that has always fascinated me and has driven me to create models both for marketing and for ad revenue, talking to agencies about bandwidth and the idea that there could be television unsiloed. Why do we have to buy media or watch things in a way that are siloed? We watch TV, we watch things on tablets, we watch things on our mobile phones, but what's wrong with the ability to have multiple screens to follow the habits that we've created with the new technology, and for an advertiser to have one buy and reach that target audience across all four streams? And so in the past few years, as we started to see the expansion of bandwidth and the practicality of putting video across that, there is the distribution model for TouchVision, where you've got on-air, online, on mobile. The on-air, obviously, are television stations, just like WDJT, and we're hoping to have an affiliate in every market. And the online and mobile are the web-enabled and the tablets and mobile devices that allow us to stream TouchVision simultaneously across all of those platforms.
What's interesting about this is, I guess, the notion that the reimagining of broadcast news, the key is that broadcast is really only one component.
It is, but broadcast, to me, expanded the first time with cable, and now broadcast means anything that you put across really any air or cable wave. So when we talk about broadcast, that's what I mean by television unsiloed. It's not just one place. Even television stations and networks are starting to take their programming and put it across other platforms, just as we are doing.
Why was Milwaukee the right place to do this first?
Milwaukee was the right place because our strategic partner had a station there, and Milwaukee is a really good town to do these types of things. It's a great cross-section of people. It's a competitive media market, and it gives us a good indication of how this is going to behave when we roll it out shortly on a national basis.
Well, and even before we set up this interview, I ran across TouchVision on what may well have been its first day on the air, but only because I happen to be channel surfing through channel 58.4. I can't imagine that is the ideal way of spreading the word. How are you going about marketing and distribution?
There are three ways that we're doing it. Number one is with our affiliate partner, which is WDJT, using their assets to reach audiences. Number two is through social media. Remember, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, they are networks. We label them as social media. So we have paid and free search going on there, and also radio and television buys in the marketplace. And we've created a media mix that, by the way, is working extremely well. We're getting a very good response to the app and to the programming.
What has been the most difficult thing to explain to people about what Touch Vision is? I suspect there's a certain amount of laying this out in terms that didn't exist not that long ago.
I think the most difficult part is not laying it out in such specific terms and following what other organizations have done before in positioning and marketing their brand. And by allowing more of the pictures and the stories to be the visual that entices people to go and check out what Touch Vision really is, that seems to be the magic in what's making this work.
You talk about being unsiloed, and it's sort of hard for me to ask this question, but do you see yourself in competition with conventional television, with conventional internet? What is your ultimate aim for this?
Absolutely not at all. We are, I think, an enhancement to our affiliate partner. Remember, we are partners with a television station that does a very good job with their news programming reaching the audience that it was intended for, mostly 50 plus. And what this does is we call this news that is targeted towards millennials plus, 18 to 34 year olds, the sweet spot being 25 to 35 years old. So I don't think this competes. This is an adjunct because, as we said, television has really not attracted the next generation of news viewers. You can look at any of the ratings in the top 25 markets as an example, and you'll see that they skew older. What we're doing is we are, in a way, reinventing the relationship between a network and its affiliate. A network is supposed to be able to produce those things that a TV station locally could do, but they might be economically not affordable for them. So if what we're saying is that here is television unsiloed, here is a national news organization with a new style of programming, a new distribution platform, and a new model of selling this that takes television into the future, then I don't think this competes at all. I think this helps them greatly.
Given the amount of time that has gone into to preparing to launch this, this must be a pretty exciting time.
It's an unbelievably wonderfully exciting time because all of the elements of this are coming together. You know, after you've done a number of new projects, whether early on, whether you've got something that's going to take hold or not, and this seems to be working extremely well, any way you want to judge it.
Well, Steve Saslow, thank you so much, and best of luck.
Thanks. Appreciate the time.
Steve Saslow is CEO of Touch Vision, a television and internet news network that launched in September. Its first local market is Milwaukee, where you can see it at digital channel 58.4. You'll find a link to the online version from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Another break now, and then a Milwaukee man's memoir of growing up in New York in the 1960s with his famous writer father. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. The writer Bruce J. Friedman was known to many in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s for novels such as Stern, stage plays such as Scuba Duba, and screenplays such as Stir Crazy, Splash, and The Lonely Guy. But to then-aspiring writer Kip Friedman, he was also known as Dad. Friedman's new memoir, Barracuda in the Attic, recalls the distinctive experiences of growing up with a literary lion as a parent. Friedman reads from his book Thursday night at Boswell Book Company, but he joins us in the studio first. Welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
You are not the first Friedman to recall your childhood and this time of your life through a book. So where does your memoir fit in telling the history of your family?
Well, that's a good question. Apparently, the Friedmans have created a cottage industry of family memoirs. My father is a writer and recently had a book called Lucky Bruce about his literary memoir, his life as a writer. My oldest brother, Josh, a few years ago, had a book called Black Cracker about his childhood, which was creative nonfiction, which is his own genre.
Right.
I decided to write a book about my childhood, a memoir, accurately bringing back to life some of the highlights, some of the exciting things that happened in my childhood, and for my own purpose, because I had a wonderful, magical childhood, and I wanted to put it back together again. You know, I wanted to have a record for it.
Well, why now? Why was this the right time to do this?
Well, I had time on my hands. I had been working full-time throughout my 30s and into my 40s, and I actually quit my full-time job to become a full-time photographer and part-time publicist. And during that period, I found myself at my computer one winter morning thinking, if I never write this story, I mean, if I don't have as much time as I do now, I'll never get it written. The story was about a time in my life after my parents divorced in the mid-1970s. I moved in with my father into his duplex apartment in Midtown Manhattan. And we were like two bachelors living together again. He was recently divorced. I was about 16, about a year and a half away from going off to college. So I wanted to recall that magical time in my life. We really had a lot of fun, went on some adventures. I got to see what his life was like as a writer, meeting with people, going on some of his business trips.
Well, and let me jump in. I mean, there's not exactly a story arc to the book, but there are themes you come back to with frequency, and one of them is your parents' on-again, off-again marriage, which in a way really seems to have given you some insight into your dad that you might not otherwise have had.
The story of my parents' on-again, off-again relationship, their several separations and eventual divorce was sort of a backdrop in my childhood. My brothers and I were each affected somewhat. I'm not painting a bad picture. My parents gave us a magical, wonderful childhood and put their emphasis on us. They were, if anything, indulgent, allowed us to be very creative. All of us wound up, big surprise, being artists. And so we felt that their dissolution of the marriage was separate somehow from our own childhood, and they made that so. Nevertheless, while I was enjoying my childhood, there was evidence in the background that this was a theme. So that shows up in a lot of my stories. But it's really a series of stories about different aspects of my childhood that were meaningful to me. I talk about my memories of my grandparents, who I bring back to life because I knew them and yet I didn't really know them. So I tried to make sense, literally, out of who they were and what they meant to me. I talk about my relationship with my brothers. Again, they were artists. They're older. My middle brother, Drew, is a famous illustrator, cartoonist. My oldest brother, Josh, is a wonderful musician and writer. He's been published. And I was the youngest brother, so I was kind of swept along following them, whether we were going to pursue the scariest horror movies on 42nd Street and Broadway or to comic book conventions at hotels and convention centers around Manhattan, or even to go to this rustic comic book store we called the Back Issue Store, where just for fun we would be let loose into this warehouse of a store in the middle of Manhattan and find old obscure comic books from the 1940s and 50s, magazines, Mad magazines, the original ones. And my father somehow found out about this place and allowed us to just go there. Most parents would have taken their kids to a movie. My dad was a little more creative.
Well, and you turned into kind of regulars there. I think you're right that the guy that ran the shop was a little skeptical at first, but then kind of got used to seeing you there.
Yeah, not many children went to this back issue store where literally backlogs of magazines were brought to. So to have these three kids running in like bulls into a China shop was a little unique for them. However, because we go there every few weeks or so, they got used to us and we became regular customers. My memories of that warehouse, the mildew, the creaky stairs, the plastic smells, the rows and rows of magazines piling up to the sky. It was really quite a magical place to go to, and we got about a half an hour or so to buy whatever we wanted within a budget and then get out of there.
New York obviously figures really heavily in this book. Do you feel like you're not just capturing your own history, but maybe providing a snapshot of New York in a certain time in its history?
We were fortunate to be raised in the New York City area in the 1960s and early 1970s. It didn't feel like a big city to us because we just were immersed in New York. There was something almost provincial about it. It still is today, I think, a series of neighborhoods. But by going to different parts of Manhattan, my father's from the Bronx, my mother's from Brooklyn, we felt very familiar and comfortable in a city of 9 million people that apparently never sleeps. After moving away to go to University of Wisconsin-Madison in the late 1970s is when I realized that it was quite a big city. I didn't really experience such a magnitude of a city till after I left it. So I come back to New York City as a tourist. But in the 1970s, it seemed small. It seemed very familiar, personal. You ran into people in neighborhoods. My father's orbit consisted of writers, of actors, producers, directors, playwrights, you name it. And you'd see a lot of these people just walking down the streets. I must have sat next to Woody Allen about three or four times at my dad's writing salon restaurant called The Lanes. It just seemed natural and real. You'd see Tom Wolfe walking down Fifth Avenue with his white outfit with a little carnation or whatever he wore, and you just say hi. I mean, it just seems small to me.
You mentioned your father's writing salon / restaurant. Where does food fit in with the story of your childhood?
Well, food is family. I'm a product of a Jewish family, so Eastern European Jewish family. So food was always there wherever we went, and if you weren't stuffed to the gills, you didn't have a meal. So that went without saying. All the traditional Jewish foods, matzo ball soup, blintzes, you name it. But being in New York City, we were able to experience foods from all over the world. And my father, being a foodie, really enjoyed discovering new types of cuisines. Indian food didn't really become popular until much later. But in the 1970s, it was very unique in New York City. Szechuan food, spicy new flavors that, people weren't used to. Cutting-edge foods, Korean food. We just found food was part of the cultural landscape. It was something you enjoyed, like going to the theater to see an opening night of a play or to see a great movie. It's to go to the Madison Square Garden and watch the New York Knicks play in a championship. It was part of everyday life in New York City.
And I think you write that to this day, your father still thinks of you as a soup person just from that period in your life.
Well, my father, being a writer, embellishes, alters, finds meaning, and makes everything seem special and unique. So growing up, he, of course, picked up on the fact that I love soup. And he would call me a famous soup man. And that went to my head. So I grew up thinking, there must be people that know of me. I'm a famous soup man. And only in retrospect, much years later, did I realize that was his way of just making me feel special and making foods more special than perhaps they really were. He has this habit of, when he sees a restaurant proclaiming to have world famous waffles on its signage, you'll say, really? I wonder if they're famous in Uganda. You know, and I still do that, and I do that with my son. Still, food has played a major role in our family.
And I gather you passed along your love for hot and sour soup to your son.
I have passed along my love of hot and sour soup to my son. My grandmother introduced it to me at a restaurant called Ruby Foo's in Midtown Manhattan in the mid-1960s. And I was proud to see that my son wrote a seventh grade essay where he wrote, "I consider myself a gourmand of sorts, and I enjoy a nice bowl of hot and sour soup now and then."
What's been the most rewarding part of getting these stories on paper?
The most rewarding part of getting these stories on paper, first of all, was to tell my father in a way that he could really relate, the written word, how special this period was for me living with him in the mid-1970s. I was sort of at a loss to where I fit. My mother had a new boyfriend. My oldest brother was moving into his own apartment. My middle brother, who had been at Boston University, was moving back in. And I wondered one day where I fit. And I didn't really see a room for myself in my mother's apartment. So my brother, Drew, my middle brother, said, "Why don't you move in with Dad?" And my father happily let me move in. And that was the story for the next year and a half.
Well, I gather he approves of the way you told it, given that he has contributed the foreword to this.
My father has been very supportive, as have all of my family members. No one has said, "You can't write about that." Everyone's been very pleased. I think I've been honest and yet gracious. It's a memoir, so I'm writing my perspective on my childhood, and I have a pretty sunny view on what happened. And I think as a trained reporter, I was a newspaper reporter my early part of my career, I was able to bring those objective reporting skills to train on my own childhood. So I felt honest. My father loves the stories. He loves the fact that I brought it back to life. He has written me a number of times saying that it's so much fun we had back in those days, and I'm so glad you were able to tell it.
Well, Kip Friedman, thank you so much for sharing this with us, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
Kip Friedman's memoir is called Barracuda in the Attic, published by Fantagraphics Books. He'll talk about the book in an onstage interview at Boswell Book Company on Thursday. It will sound a lot like this one because I will be asking the questions again. You'll find a link to more from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break and then a preview of Digital Billboard Art Month, which starts today. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. We've all noticed vinyl billboards giving way more and more to digitals. Some people love them, others not so much. One local public art advocate saw opportunity, though, and spearheaded what's euphemistically being called Digital Billboard Art Month. In truth, over the next 10 days, as 18 billboards rotate from image to image, one will feature a local visual artist. WUWM's Susan Bentz met the project visionary Peggy Christensen at the busy corner of 25th and St. Paul when her scheme was still evolving.
As I look east, there are two digital billboards. There's also a vinyl billboard. There's huge signage. As I look north, there are two billboards. As I look south, there are two billboards. And as I look west, there are two billboards. So we're in an area with 10 billboards in my 360-degree field of vision.
That conversation happened April of last year, and Christensen was already deeply immersed in strategizing. She had just sent a letter to major billboard companies, Lamar and Clear Channel, hoping that one would bite.
What I am suggesting is that one day a year, starting in 2013, the two key companies with digital billboards in the city of Milwaukee would donate a billboard dedicated to art images with no ad content.
Are you scratching your head wondering why an environmental reporter is telling you the story? Digital billboards are not free of controversy. Debate ranges from concern that rapidly changing ads will distract drivers and cause injury to e-waste created at a billboard's end of life. At the time, Christensen said a federal highway traffic study on some of these issues was expected any minute.
And I'm very curious to see that because there may be changes. They may slow them down. They may have questions about text.
But months have passed without any sign of federal study results. Christensen, who is first and foremost a temporary public art advocate, wasn't about to put the brakes on her vision.
Nationally, art on billboards, both vinyl and digital, is growing. Richmond, Virginia, has sponsored art on digital billboards since 2010. And the project has spread across the country, including Chicago and Detroit, Michigan.
Since her idea first sprouted, the project's scope has evolved. After both major billboard companies got behind the project, 18 organizations submitted a total of 67 images to be considered for 8 Seconds in the Sun. I meet Christensen along with Graham Reed at an Eastside gallery. Reed, director of collections and exhibitions at the Museum of Wisconsin Art, curated the selection process. He says it's not your average judging criteria.
It's large scale. It's going to be seen from a distance. Most often than not, people who are going to see this work are going to be moving quite fast. So obviously there had to be something very immediate, very visual about it, where people could look, see, comprehend, really in the matter of seconds.
His choices ranged from painting to sculpture and photography, drawn from 18 different local arts organizations.
Coalition of Photographic Arts, MIAD, Alverno, the Haggerty, but then we've got a couple of others that, you know, a lot of people might not be particularly familiar with. We've got Very Special Arts Wisconsin, which specifically deals with people with disabilities, their artwork, and then the Grand Avenue Club, which is an organization that has specific focus on people with mental illness.
Reed says themes range too, from thought-provoking to whimsical. One photographer drew from his past working at a shipyard on Jones Island.
So what you've got is a black and white image of, on the right-hand side of the picture, you can see this massive hull of a ship. And then just in the foreground is a worker making a snowball. In the background, his colleague is doing a handstand.
Peggy Christensen guides us around the corner to Oakland and North Avenue. It's one of the 18 billboard locations showcasing art. She's still dizzy with the project's evolution.
So instead of one billboard for a day, there are 18 billboards for 10 days. Over 1 million people will see at least one of these images during these 10 days is well beyond what I ever envisioned.
Before our conversation ends, Christensen quickly adds,
I think it's just going to create a real interest in what happens and what we see in our environment every day. Got to get that environment in there.
For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Peggy Christensen is the founder of Insight, an arts organization that's cultivated temporary public art installations in unexpected places since 2006. Digital Billboard Art Month runs through October 10th. You'll find more about the show and its 18 billboards at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Tuesday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich. It's so great to have you listening today, as it is every day, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.